Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. We have Natalie Liu, who's 46, is a boundaries and relationship coach, who's the creator of one of the longest running self-help blogs in the world, Baggage Reclaim, and the Baggage Reclaim Sessions podcast. The England-born, Ireland-raised author helps people understand how their emotional baggage is interfering with their ability to live their lives happily and authentically. Topics she particularly well known for include emotional unavailability, recognizing shady behavior, people-pleasing, and values, needs, and boundaries. Natalie's authored 5 books, including Mr. Unavailable and The Fallback Girl and The Joy of Saying No, the paperback of which just came out in the U.S. Her advice has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, NPR, USA Today, and the BBC, among many others. Natalie lives in Caterham on the edge of South London with her husband, 2 teenage daughters, and a cockapoo. It is super exciting in this day and age to have such an expert on this field of what is so hard for so many of us, including myself, which is boundaries and the ability to say no and the joy of saying no and what that means for the respect for ourselves and the respect for when we say yes. So I'm super excited to have this amazing episode coming out in a time that is so overwhelmingly boundaryless. So before we get started, here's a word from our sponsors. Hello, this week's episode is sponsored by Alma. Going in network with insurance can be really tough. The paperwork, who to talk to, how to get it done, all the wait time to be able to work with certain clients. Filling all of the right paperwork is time-consuming and tedious, and even after you're done, it can take months to get credentialed and start seeing clients. That's why Alma makes it easy and financially rewarding to accept insurance. When you join their insurance program, you can get credentialed within 45 days and access enhanced reimbursement rates with major payers. They also handle all the paperwork, from eligibility checks to claim submissions, and guarantee payment within 2 weeks of each appointment. Once you've joined Alma's insurance program, you can see clients in your state of licensure regardless of where you're working from. You know, it's been really wonderful to partner with Alma and use it myself. Without them, I probably would not be able to do what I do as a private therapist, having a private practice in 2 states. So learn more about building a thriving private practice with Alma at helloalma.com. That's hello, ALMA.com to get started. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. We have Natalie Liu on to talk about a really interesting topic, the joy of saying no. And most people associate saying no as like, I hate doing that, I can't, don't make me. And there's the other side is like, excited to say no because they hate people and don't want to do anything. And in her book, The Joy of Saying No, that came out, it dives into some really important topics. And without further ado, Natalie, can you introduce yourself to the listeners so we can kind of get right into the conversation that I think I know impacts me? I know it impacts a lot of people I know, and I'm sure a lot of people that you know as well.
Thank you for having me, Eli. I am Natalie. I have been writing about relationships, self-esteem, dating for about coming up to 19 years. And for almost 18 of those, I've done that at my website, baggagereclaim.com. And as you said, I recently wrote a book called The Joy of Saying No. And really, the reason why I do the work that I do is to help the people pleasers, perfectionists, overthinkers of this world to break those habits because they cause them to be involved with emotionally unavailable and shady people, to accept less than what they need from, you know, from their careers, from their various relationships, from the opportunities that they're presented with, and also just have a better life because we all deserve love, care, trust, and respect. And yeah, I have a podcast, The Baggage Reclaim Sessions, which has been going for several years now. And I've written several books, including Mr. Unavailable and The Fallback Girl, which was my first one.
I'm so excited because I know I have struggled in the past with people pleasing. And what shifted for me that distinction was when I became a therapist and I started helping other people break out of those things and also coming to a realization when I had, I think it was also having kids, where I said, I don't care if you're unhappy with my no. This is what needs to happen for me to say yes to something else. And so I want to just backtrack just for a hot second. We could talk about people pleasers a lot, but what, this might not be the right question, but what creates or how does someone get into that role or mindset of a people pleaser? Where does it come from and how does it exist?
That is actually a great question. So we are socialized and conditioned into being people pleasers. What I say in the book is that if you're not a child right now, then you grew up in the age of obedience, which is where the communicating, you know, disciplining, interacting with children centered on making them as obedient, as excessively compliant as possible with authorities. And we have grown up in a world that is like, this is good and this is bad. And this, you be meek and mild and sweet. Don't talk out of turn. You know, you are disobeying me if you say that you feel a particular way. So as children, we depend on our parents and caregivers for our survival. We pick up messages about what is good and what is bad, and we try to do more of what we think is good so that we gain attention, affection, approval, love, and validation, or to avoid conflict, criticism, additional stress, disappointment, loss, rejection, or what we might term as abandonment. So we are made into people pleasers because of the environment that we grew up in, because of the time that we grew up in, which basically said, comply or you are displeasing. But we have also sometimes received messages from people around us that certain things make us more desirable, make us more worthy, make us more purposeful. So we're like, oh, well, I'll do more of that. If I please others, that'll work out well for me. So essentially what we've done is we have become disassociated from our feelings, and our identities have become based on this idea of what we think makes a pleasing and good person. And what we don't realize is that these are, you know, survival coping strategies that we've learned in childhood, but that they become maladaptive once we are in adulthood. So they become increasingly ineffective because we're not supposed to continue trying to be compliant.
And I love that idea, and I see that very much. But where were and was that wrong for parents or authority to teach us good and bad? And how are we shifting that to be better for our future kids? Like, I know as a parent myself, I got two little humans, and it's my responsibility to help them see what is good and bad, what is right and wrong, so they survive and thrive in the future. Don't get arrested, don't get hurt, are safe, successful, productive, happy, healthy people. So where is that line of educating, but not forcing them and then feeling like they are beholden to me, which then might create the people-pleasing mentality?
So I think before, there was this sense that an authority is always right. Mm-hmm. And that as a child, if an authority tells you to do something or to not do something, then you must obey that. Mm-hmm. And this was all based on the premise that an authority always has your best interests at heart and that they are, as such, always right. But we know that that is not always the case. And an authority to a child is somebody who has power over them. So typically, as a kid, that's an adult or somebody that they're afraid of. But we know based on the stories that have come out about what our parents and grandparents, what our own generation has been through with authorities, mm-hmm. that some authorities abuse that desire for us to please and to be good. And they also abuse this sense of compliance. So if you turn around and you say to the person who's actually trying to abuse you, you know, to get away from you, you're seen as being difficult and you don't want to get into trouble with that person or with your parents. And so you continue. Now, what we're seeing is that the parenting of children has become more of a two-way rather than a one-way relationship. Like you, I've got two children. My children are teenagers, and they are aware of things that I just quite simply was not at the same age. And they have been really from the get-go. They are aware of things like feelings and boundaries and values. And they know that if they don't want to, for instance, hug and kiss a relative, or if they, I don't know, feel uncomfortable around somebody that they're unfamiliar with, they know that it is okay to recognize that discomfort. That doesn't mean that they don't struggle with it, because I think that that is part of the sort of evolution of us as children into teenagers and then into adults. But they understand that they don't have to blindly obey somebody just because they are an adult. And I think we were taught about right and wrong, and for want of a better term, good versus bad, for a place of shame. Mm. And that's not to say that that still doesn't exist, because clearly there are people who still teach from that place. Mm-hmm. But I think there's more nuance to it, in the sense of we are allowing our children to have their own identities. Mm-hmm. We're not teaching them that if they don't want to be like us, and that if they don't always do exactly what we tell them to do, that it means that they don't love us, or that they are a bad kid, mm-hmm. you know, that they are not good. So there's a real difference between what previous generations have been through. And keep in mind, you know, something I stress to people is, if we grew up in the age of obedience, which was going on for several hundred years, our parents and our grandparents and our ancestors grew up in that. So our parents and grandparents and so forth parented from that place. So what was happening is there was this sort of passing down of, oh, this is good and this is bad. And of course, there are certain things that are wrong. But being different isn't wrong. Being an introvert or an extrovert isn't wrong. Being gay isn't wrong. Being neurodiverse or left-handed isn't wrong. Not wanting to go to church doesn't make you a bad person. Going to church also doesn't make you a bad person. Having sexual desires doesn't make you a bad person. There are so many things that we were told, oh, this is the marker of what is a good versus a bad person. A good person has been somebody who's like, you've ticked the boxes. So you appear to be, I guess, popular, and you have a good job, and maybe you are married and you live in a nice home. And that's what a lot of people think is a good person. That's crazy.
But I also think, by the way, that you made an unbelievable point, other than the clarification of the idea that when you are doing something to not make someone upset, and that there is this, in this day and age, I love you no matter which way you choose. Now, I might try to steer, educate, or open your eyes to options, right? Not just black and white, but gray as well. Mm-hmm. That when my daughter says, no, I don't want to watch that movie, and I say, okay, and I listen, versus saying, shut up, we're watching this movie because I want to watch it, right? Yeah. Or like, for example, something happened recently. My daughter all of a sudden had this idea in her head that girls don't wear pants. Girls only wear skirts. Now, we live in a household. Now, I'm an Orthodox Jew. My wife doesn't really wear pants out of the house, but we don't teach her that. She's a kid. She's three. She's a kid. Mm-hmm. We don't care. Wear pants and a t-shirt. Who cares?
Yeah.
Right? Someone at school, a girl in her school, is very adamant about loving the way she wears dresses. So now she wants to wear dresses. Okay. We have plenty of dresses for her. I picked out an outfit. It was like a tracksuit, you know, sweat, you know, from Target. We love Target. Mm-hmm. Hi, Target. And if you're listening, please sponsor me. I will buy everything in your store, which I already do. So what can we do? And she's like, no, daddy, I want to wear a dress. Now, I had an option. I could have said, I went upstairs, I picked out this outfit, you're wearing what I said, stop it. Or I could have said, let's make a compromise. Can you wear pants with the dress because it's cold outside? And we did that because it's not my word versus hers. She's a person with thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
And I think if we live in a world where we educate our children to think that it's my way or the highway and I am the ruler, what it creates is that if I do something that is against what you say, I am now bad.
Yeah.
Right. And that creates people pleasers, where I have to constantly be beholden to someone else in their good light or in their good view. And I have to make myself and my needs smaller so that you are successful, better, you know, right. Let's say, let's just use that word.
Absolutely. I mean, you are spot on with that. It's this sense of what you did there was, as you said, you entered into a dialogue with her. You were able to recognize, look, this is what you're feeling about this particular thing. How about we do a bit of this and that? Because turning around and saying, I picked out this thing for you. It doesn't matter whether you want to wear something else, centers your feelings about having gone upstairs and got a tracksuit rather than listening to what your child is saying. And, you know, something that I hear from a lot of people is, and, you know, I had this experience myself, you know, you turn around and you would express a feeling or an opinion and it'd be like, what are you going on about that for? When I was your age, I didn't have clothes or shoes, or I didn't get to do this, or you don't realize
I walked up the hill barefoot both ways in the snow.
Yeah. And, you know, you're being a brat or you're being spoiled. And when you engage in this dialogue where you have a little bit of curiosity about where your kid is coming from, you get to understand them rather than sort of superimposing your way, you know, onto them. And something I say to people is if you are in an ongoing dialogue with your child and you allow them to talk to you about the small stuff and to express, their frustration sometimes, but they will come to you about the big stuff when they need to. But if they start to get the message that rightly or wrongly, that, you know, they think that you need them to be perfect and to always be compliant and to make sure that you're good in a particular way, you will get a people pleaser. And you will also get somebody who doesn't really feel as if they can be truly honest about themselves with you because they fear that they're going to be rejected in some way by you.
And I would also add for anyone who's listening, now I'm a parenting specialist, and I want to just be very clear. It doesn't mean you can't say no.
Right? Absolutely.
So for example, my daughter sometimes doesn't want to go to school and she's like, Daddy, I don't want to go. You're going to school, right? That's, you have to go to school. Or safety issues, right? There are things that, like, let's say, for example, like your kid's allergic to something, you don't give it to them just because they cry because their friend had it. But there's a very big distinction you need to add. You have to validate and understand where they're coming from because they are humans and they're frustrated. So if my kid says, I don't want to go to school, and I say, hey, my love, my little lady, I call her Rickster. I said, Rickster, I understand you don't want to school and you're frustrated, but mommy and daddy are working. There's no one there to take care of you. And we need you to go to school because in the end, every day I pick you up, you love school. You love your friends. You're so happy after school. Why don't you want to go to school? Because I want to stay home and watch TV. You can watch TV when you get home. The TV's not going anywhere.
The TV will still be here.
TV's not going anywhere, I promise. Unless someone comes and takes it away, I'm going to be upset because I love TV. So, like, don't worry. The TV's not going anywhere. I'll protect the TV. I'll make sure we watch. What would you like to watch when we get home?
Yeah.
Right? So it's not, shut up. No, you're going to school because I said so, right? It's, I hear that you're frustrated. It's not that you're not, it's not that you're being a rolling over kind of parent. We're not talking about that, right? Because you can still say no and not create a people pleaser. And recently, I read, I had this book on my shelf for a couple of years now, and I've been pushing it off because either people send me books or I have interviews and I need to prepare for that, whatever the reason is. Susan David's Emotional Agility.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot the terminology, and the book's like over there somewhere, and I don't want to get it because I'm too lazy. But there's a concept of the rule of thumb, She has a better psychological terminology that starts with an H that I can't think of right now.
Yeah, I can't think of it either.
And I tabbed it, by the way, last night. I tabbed it for this interview. And so there goes my ADHD brain. Welcome, everyone, to Forgetting Things. And sometimes if we are taught what is good or bad, or we are conditioned to believe certain things are, without questioning or coming to our own sense of that, we sometimes will fall very quickly into the rule of thumb. Oh, this scenario happened? Turn on that scenario, that box. Oh, this is coming up? We do this, right? For example, my daughter saying, girls don't wear pants. That's someone creating a rule of thumb for her to fall back into, or gender roles, or sexual identity, and things of that nature. Society can do this, do that to us too, but that's what people pleasing is. Oh, I have a boss. I'm going to get pushed into a certain perspective that is being forced. That's not my own. And I don't know why I do it sometimes, but I get pulled into it. And I remember reading that this week and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so many of us, where I have clients who say like, oh, I have a, like I have a client of mine who, oh, I have to be nice to everyone so everyone feels comfortable. Why?
Yeah, why?
Why is it your job to make everyone comfortable? Because
also, how do you know if they're comfortable?
Exactly, right? These are the pushbacks that I feedback I give him in therapy. How do you know that? Why do you feel that way? Oh, because in my household, I had to be the happy one because everyone else is upset. There we go.
Boom.
There we go. That's your people pleaser, right? So,
yeah,
you know, a lot of things of that. And I want to just jump in, and I'm sure you have many thoughts on what I just said, but I want to make sure we get into your amazing book. You know, people have this very general rule of people pleasers. People pleasers are doing things for others so that they're happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Making other people happy, sometimes at your, you know, detriment or
expense.
Fault.
Yeah.
Expense, that's the word. But in your book, you have five different types of people pleasers. And I don't think people understand or know what that is. So can you kind of give a rundown of what are the five types and what are they like? How does it look practically and maybe in your head?
Yeah, I love as well that you recognize that. I think people either think that people pleasing is about, oh, that makes me like a really kind and generous and conscientious person, and I'm just always like doing stuff for others. Or it's like, I'm a total doormat. And I wanted to really blow open our idea of people pleasing because I kept seeing the same patterns again and again. And I realized that people pleasers have core, like different core drivers. And so there are gooders. These are people who they are focused on appearing good, being liked. They're driven by this need to be perceived as a good person in whatever form that means. And it might not necessarily that they're always doing good, but they need other people to think that that is them. And so they will please people if they think, oh, well, that will make me liked. Somebody who is an efforter is somebody who, as the name suggests, is very focused on effort. I'm an efforter. So I have very much been about, it's not enough for me to appear good to others. I have to use my effort to prove that I am enough, to prove that I am best. So efforters are about being the best, perfectionism, giving 100%, you know, making sure that they have put in enough effort. They are trying to prove themselves because maybe they haven't had the recognition that they have always sought, or they have learned to associate their worth with their efforts because they've been praised. Oh, you work so hard, you try so hard, you're the best, you do so well at your exams. Avoiders, their way of trying to please people is exactly what your client was doing. So where they will avoid anything that they think is going to cause any inconvenience or discomfort to others. They, like all people pleasers, have a level of discomfort. You know, all people pleasers have a level of discomfort with conflict, but an avoider is so concerned about not discomforting others that they are like, they have a very heightened fear of making any form of difference known. So they're the ones who, you know, when you're, for instance, dating them and you say, oh, you know, what do you like? Oh, I like what you like. you know, like in Coming to America when he gets it to hop up and down and bark like a dog. It is that sort of, I like what you like. I want to do whatever you want to do. So, you know, merging into the other person, going along with things, but then feeling like, oh, I'm pleasing the person by being whatever they want me to be. And then feeling resentful when that person expresses something that they don't like. Mm-hmm. Savers are the people pleasers of this world who try to please others by being of service. So they are the helpers, the fixers, the saviors, the rescuers. They please others by essentially sacrificing themselves. And they tell themselves that this is a good thing. And often they've grown up in an environment where they've told that it's a really selfless thing to put yourself out for others. And so they're the one who always volunteers themselves. They're rescuing somebody in a relationship. They're carrying everybody else's problems. And they don't ask for enough help because they're too busy doing stuff for others. But on some level, like all people pleasers, they're hoping to get something back in exchange for what it is that they're doing. And then sufferers are people pleasers who believe that the more you suffer, the better it makes you as a person. Like, I suffer so much, that's a sign of how good I am. That's a sign of how much I love. I bleed for you, type of thing. And they may have been engaged in the other types of people pleasing, but it's like they've fallen on their sword somewhat, where it's like, I'm going to give up my boundaries and let you treat me whatever which way, or I'm going to hide my needs and be in a desperate, painful place in the hopes that you go, oh, wow. Thank you so much for suffering for me. Here, let me finally meet your needs. And of course, that is not what happens. And what I say is that more often than not, we tend to have a strong leaning towards one or two of the types of people pleaser. Like, I know I am very much an efforter. I've dabbled in the others. You know, I have concerned myself about being a good girl. I can be very like, oh my gosh, am I breaking a rule type of thing? But I am, effort is where I'm at. If I'm going to lose sleep over something, if I'm going to try hard over something, I'm going to be about effort. Somebody else might be more concerned with like, why don't they like me? Like, what reason don't they have to like me? I'm not necessarily too concerned with that. So it is understanding what tends to drive you, what keeps you awake at night, what tends to stress you out, or what tends to be your Achilles heel. You know, is it that you pride yourself on being, for instance, a good employee, so you don't have any work boundaries, or, you know, a good Christian or a good Jew or whatever it is, like you're trying to prove yourself about that, but mm-hmm. then you're kind of out of integrity in some way because you're so hung up on that image that you can't be who you mm-hmm. really are. Whatever it is, pay attention to what is it that you tend to get hung up on? Where do you mm-hmm. place a lot of value? In appearance, in effort, in helping, in avoiding, or suffering?
Mm. Wow. I never thought of it in those ways. And the funny thing is that when I think of it, I think of people that, for example, like the goody person, yeah. The client that I work with, he feels he needs to laugh to make other people happy.
Wow.
At jokes.
Yeah.
Right? When they're not funny. He's like, I have to laugh because I feel bad. I don't want them to feel bad about, right?
Wow.
Or the idea of, and I think, you know, myself included, I think a lot of cultures create the efforting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
it's a cultural thing, like religiously, like service or proving or going to synagogue or prayer mm-hmm. or like a production based, right? And yeah. I happen to really appreciate my parents for doing this. When I was a kid, I have ADHD. And when I was a kid, my grades were not great. School was not for me. And my dad always joked, like, if I got an 80s, he'd be like, where are the other 10 points as a joke? And he would smile afterwards. Like, and I knew he was joking. I never yeah. thought that he was being serious. But the theme was, did you try your hardest?
Yeah.
Right. And I know people who was, I remember vividly, there was a girl in my class in seventh grade. I will never forget this. In seventh grade, got a 99 and cried because she didn't get 100 and her parents were going to be upset. Right?
Wow.
Bawled her eyes out. I still remember her name. I remember where she was in the school because it was like, oh my goodness. And there are cultures that put that pressure on performance. There's this new TV show on called The Parent Test. on Hulu, and there's a parent parenting unit that they are so regimented in this kid's life to be Harvard success, Yale story kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They don't understand the impact. Yes, they it will create a successful robot.
Yes,
but it will not create a human. Right?
No, it won't.
And I love this idea of avoiding. I think that to me is something that I have struggled with, is not ruffling feathers. And I know why, right? Growing up, you know, my brother was a lot to deal with, more than me. And if I stayed in my place, if I did well and was quiet or didn't rock the boat, because he took that role, he rocked the boat. I couldn't, right? My parents could not handle that. And sometimes, and I've grown so much that when I do rock the boat, I go, oh my God, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
I'm just speaking my mind or talking or being, or just being myself. And I would love to hear, because the idea of, it's not just about saying no as a people pleaser, right? That's a part of it, right? I think for the service, that's a huge part, learning how to say no with confidence without guilt. Mm-hmm. Because you can't say yes to everything. You have limitations, priorities at this time. You cannot push yourself past what you can say. And I just saw an interview about Amy Schumer, that she's really good when someone says, hey, can you do this? She goes, no. And she doesn't give a reason. She doesn't say like, oh, I'm so sorry, maybe next time. She goes, nope, I can't. Just straight up, no, I can't. Without having to defend or protect herself why she can't. But there's more to it to combat people pleasing other than no. What are some of those things that we have to do for ourselves? Because I think most human beings fall into some of these categories one way or another,
or
than one. So how do we, not just saying no, but how do we even start working or becoming aware of this? If that's all we've done all our life, how do we learn to become our authentic self? And what does that even mean?
So you've alluded to a key part of this already, which is starting to get awareness of how people pleasing manifests in your life. What do you think it is your job to be and do in life? I'm not talking about as in the job that you're working. You'll notice that there's a pattern to the roles that you play in your relationships. And that's because it's the role that you've learned. And you have learned, for instance, to dim your light, to be quiet, to not make waves, because as so many people arrive at people pleasing for the same reason, it's like, well, somebody else is already doing that and I need to be good. And what it is about getting to know your pleaser, because even though there is going to be crossover with all of us in terms of people pleasing, it shows up in very specific ways in our life, in specific situations or around specific people. And so what I encourage people to do, and it's the first step that I share in the book, is getting to know your pleaser. And that is spending a week observing how you spend your yes, no, and maybe, because then you get a sense of how you're essentially spending your bandwidth, which is your attention. How are you spending your time, energy, efforts, and emotion over the course of a week? And you try to do it with as little judgment as possible, but it's paying attention to who's triggering what I call the people pleaser feelings, which are guilt, anxiety, resentment, overwhelm, feeling overloaded, helplessness, powerlessness, feeling low. Those are the people pleaser feelings. They're telling you that you have done what might, for all intents and purposes, be a good thing, but for the wrong reasons. And when you are willing to observe how you spend your yes, no, and maybe, you will see your people pleaser clear as day. Because a lot of people think, oh, well, if I'm a people pleaser, then I must be it right across the board. But some people, a lot of people, there are specific areas of their life really tend to push their buttons for it, with it. So they find that actually they can say no, express their limits, you know, not exploit themselves or allow others to exploit them. For instance, with the familial relationships, they have a good sense of who they are, but when they get into work, it's come off the rails. Or a lot of people, it's that when they get into romantic relationships, you wouldn't even know this person in it, because something gets activated, and they go into this whole mode. You see them in another context, like with work or with friends, you're like, how can this be the same person? So it's about getting to know your pleaser, getting to know what roles do you tend to play? Are you the listener? Are you the scapegoat? Are you the fixer? Are you the diplomat, the peacemaker, the over-responsible? And pay attention to what those are, because that important first step makes you aware of where your people pleaser is showing up. Other ways as well that you can do this is, as I said, you know, I mentioned those people pleaser feelings. Notice when they emerge, because as soon as you start to pay attention to these feelings, it's like, oh, my body's letting me know that I am people pleasing. Mm-hmm. If you are not aware of your feelings, which is common for people who are really up at that sort of frequent, chronic end of people pleasing, you might not be aware of your feelings. How can you be when you're an autopilot running around pleasing? So then notice the thoughts. Because then, for instance, somebody asks you to do something or makes a request, and in outwardly you're going, yeah, sure. Inwardly, you're like, this beep, beep, beep. I can't believe they turn around and ask me, don't they realize how tired I am? Or you're already trying to work out how you can get out of the thing that you've just agreed to. So notice those kind of thoughts. Notice where you're pressuring yourself, where it's like, well, I could say no to this, but then people might think badly of me, or maybe people are going to like talk about me. What if I miss out? These types of thoughts are letting you know that right now, if you were to say yes, it would not be for authentic reasons. So paying attention to those thoughts or to the feelings, and then you can choose another one. Pay attention to your why. So there are lots of us. There are plenty of people in this world who do things for others because they literally want to. They are aware of their bandwidth, their motivations. In instances where they realize that something isn't a fit, they will act on that and create boundaries for that. But then there are us people pleasers who do those similar things. So stay behind at work, help out a friend, help out a family member, do something for a romantic partner. But on some level, we are afraid that if we don't, that it's going to lead to negative consequences. So we're not saying yes because we want to. We're saying it because we were on autopilot, or we're saying it because we're trying to avoid conflict or criticism. You know, we're trying to look a particular way. All people-pleasing has some hidden agenda in there. And this is something that all people pleasers have a degree of discomfort with, because of course we like to see ourselves as being nice and sweet and loving and kind and generous. And we are. And also we are out of touch with the why behind what we're doing. That's why one of the hallmarks of people pleasing is when things don't go your way, you know, people let you down, you go, after everything I did for that person, after everything I've done, this is letting you know, ooh, you've been people pleasing. There's a hidden agenda.
Yeah.
So it's noticing that why. It's the why that makes it people pleasing. If you think doing something is going to make you look like a better something, it's going to help you avoid something else, this is people pleasing. It's not an authentic reason to say yes.
Oh, yes. So, and I think it's so amazing that I think there's a huge distinction that needs to be understood, that when you find your authentic self and finally understand what you want to do, by saying yes doesn't mean you're now falling back into a bad place. You are just now doing it because it matters to you. And, you know, I've had a few clients where I've worked heavily on their boundaries. And it's so interesting. I don't know if I wrote a post about this or I planned to and I didn't post it or not, whatever. When we make boundaries, it hurts so many more people. It bothers people. It affects people. It annoys people because they've been so used to getting away with things, maybe not on purpose, but getting what they need from you or out of you or from you. Or, and now you're like, no. And they're like, what? Huh? And it ripple affects their life. And people don't like that. It doesn't mean it's wrong, though.
Oh, 100%. Like, first of all, those people are what I call your people-pleasing entourage. You know, like with celebrities when they got those hanger-ons. And when you're like coconut up, that entourage is like, yeah, you crack on there, because they're enjoying the high life while your life is unraveling, right? So people yeah. pleasers have a similar thing where there are certain people, not all of the people in their life, who, when they turn around and finally create some form of boundary, so they say no, they express limits, they are clearer about who they are. Yeah. Some people are like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
But something that I also say to people is, of course, we're going to feel uncomfortable about saying no. You can't go mm-hmm. through all or most of your life saying yes inauthentically, avoiding no, or leaving no until you're in like a 911 backs against the wall situation, and just expect to leap out of bed tomorrow morning and say no and feel comfortable. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. First of all, the body likes familiarity. So that part of our brain that handles fear, we get the signal of fear simply by being in an unfamiliar situation. It feels threatening. So when we turn around and say no, or we express a need and we then experience this sort of anxiety and we're like, oh my God, we feel like something terrible is about to happen. It's not because our need is wrong or our no is wrong. It's because your body is so unfamiliar with you paying any attention whatsoever to your needs, wants, expectations, feelings, and opinions, that it's like it's gone, alert, alert, what the hell is this person doing? Danger, danger, it's doing something unfamiliar. It's not mm-hmm. wrong, it is unfamiliar. It means that you have not got enough information on file about saying no and expressing limits and being honest about who you are for your nervous system to actually feel mm-hmm. comfortable with you doing it. And it's not going to magically feel better without you having a go and discovering, oh, wait a second, the sky is still up in the sky. Mm-hmm. The world is still turning. Armageddon has not happened. Mm.
Yes. And I think that we conflate the two ideas, that because I'm getting a feeling or a reaction, it means that I need to stop.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're just not used to it. For example, I always say, I say this line often, I have a chronic illness called Crohn's.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. I'm doing so much better than I used to. And I remember this line that I say sometimes, people, how are you doing? And I say, I don't remember the last day I was sick.
Wow.
And I used to say, I don't remember the last day I was healthy. Right. But that took time to get to that mindset where I felt comfortable. And there were days where I was getting better and I was nervous about feeling better because I wasn't used to it. And I was like, what's going on here? This is not right. I have to be sick today because I've been sick the past 3 days or whatever it is. I was in such a state of, this is what I'm used to. And mm-hmm. I think when we start the process, I would highly suggest, first of all, talking to a therapist or a professional while you're starting this journey, so you have someone as feedback objectively to push back on your natural nervous response of uneasiness and uncertainty, mm-hmm. because it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel weird. It's like, for example, when you go to the gym and work out differently than you ever done before, your body's going to be like, what the hell are you doing? This hurts, right? You're not just going to stop. Some people might, but if you want to keep going, you're going to keep going and you need someone to push you because it's going to be uncomfortable. Right. So, and I think that, one of the last questions I have is, when you start this journey and you start this road, how do you express that to others? How do you let people know that this is not okay? Like, how do you express the no in a better way? Mm-hmm. And also, how do you let people in to this new you and this new reality that now has come about because of it?
So there can be this temptation when we realize that we have not necessarily had the best of boundaries and that we are a people pleaser and that, maybe there are certain people around us who have taken advantage at best and in some instances been abusive. There can be this temptation to immediately sort of sit them down and be like, I've realized all of these things and you've done da 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 da. And of course, it's not going to go down too well. Mm-hmm. And what can happen is, despite the best of intentions, you can end up violating your own boundaries because you end up feeling unsafe. Mm-hmm. But also the other person can end up going on the defense or even the offense, mm-hmm. and sort of feeling like, oh, I want to disprove you. So what I think it takes a while before you necessarily turn around and spell out, oh, this is what I'm doing. Because what I say to people is, don't expect to just leap out of bed tomorrow and be like, right, I'm just going to fire out all of my no bullets on everybody, mm-hmm. and tell everybody how it is. And instead, it start gently so that you can build up. Because I think that unless it necessitates you doing something, saying no to something really big straight away, mm-hmm. most people get quite triggered mm-hmm. by that. So it's starting by, first of all, getting a feel for what is going on in your life, mm-hmm. you know, that figuring out, you know, getting to know your pleaser. And then it's about understanding, okay, well, I'm not taking away from what anybody else has done, but what is my responsibility? What do I now realize that I need to be clearer about? Whether it's about saying no, expressing a limit, or just being clearer about who I am in that instance. And then endeavoring to consistently communicate that. And mm-hmm. that can be through our actions, and it can also be through words. I do say to people, if your sentence has the word boundaries in it, you're probably not being boundaried. As in, you know, when you say, my boundaries are blah, blah, blah. it's because one of the things I say to people is, we are our boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. So everything about how we show up in the world, what we say, what we don't say, what we do, what we don't do, communicates our boundaries. I think we've mm-hmm. had too much of a focus on boundaries being about no. Like, oh, it's telling people what to do and ruling others. Mm-hmm. But when I say to you, what's your name? And you turn around and say, it's Eli. And I turn around and call you Emma. I'm overstepping your boundaries mm-hmm. there. Because you've just expressed a boundary when you told me that your name is Eli. Mm-hmm. So these are just, that's a simple way of mm-hmm. us recognizing, oh, hold on. Everything we do is about our boundaries. Everything is about us communicating who we are and who we aren't, what is and isn't permissible, what feels good and right for us. So our boundaries are as much about our yes as they are about our no. And it's about being authentic with our yes and no. So in terms of any conversation we might have with people, I think that if the situation warrants it, we might have it early on simply because there's a situation coming up there and then. Mm-hmm. So we might be like, I've realized I don't really feel comfortable when you do. Or in future, I know you've been asking me, you've been saying, oh, I needed a babysit and giving me like 1 hour's notice. But actually, you know, I hold my hands up. I haven't said anything to you before, but from now on, I'm going to need you to give me at least a few days notice so that I can let you know if that's something that's in my schedule, for instance, mm-hmm. rather than you just spring it on me and then I'm just expected to drop everything. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of a situation, and that's a real life situation. I actually know somebody whose neighbor just took to dropping their kid off every single day mm-hmm. for like the best part of a year. No real conversation had or anything. Mm-hmm. And it was just assumed. She was like, oh, can you have them? And my friend would be like, well, and then the kid's there. And then she turned around and said, actually, I can't do this. And you need to ask and I need notice. And funny mm-hmm. enough, she was gone straight away, like after that. So that's an example of the situation coming up. But otherwise, show. I encourage people to show as opposed to tell. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So express it through the choices that you're making coming up. So for instance, you might realize, actually, you've been taking on far too much at work. So then the next time something is presented to you with that, it's like, actually, I don't have the bandwidth for that at the moment. Or mm-hmm. if I'm going to do this, then we're going to need to move this to a different deadline. Mm-hmm. What would you prefer to do? Mm-hmm. These are the ways in which we can start to communicate our boundaries without necessarily turning around and going, you know what? I've kind of had this come to Jesus moment where I've realized that I've been a people pleaser and I need you to stop telling me what to do because it's mm-hmm. it's not going to go anywhere fast. Mm.
And so just a follow-up question to that is, you know, how do you deal with someone who doesn't respect that? Because yeah. like, let's say you have a boss, right? Mm-hmm. is it like, okay, well, this person I'm expecting, I'm done, I'm leaving, I'm quitting, or like a parent or a sibling or a partner, someone who's close. I'm not talking about a job right now. I'm talking about your personal life.
Yeah.
Or a friend who's been in your life for years who you love, but isn't just respecting this idea. How do you deal with that?
This is a biggie. And I think it's something that a lot of people go through, and there's a grieving period, I think, almost, that comes with that as well. This realization that someone is quite dependent on you having lesser boundaries than you do right now. And that no matter how you show up and how you say it, whether you say it sweetly, nicely, a little bit intensely, harshly, they're not budging. And when we know that we are being boundaried from our side of things, because something I talk about is how boundaries are twofold. So we can be aware of what the boundary is for others and what does and doesn't work for us. And we also need to reflect it in our behavior and choices. So when we know that we are taking care of ourselves, trying to be more honest about who we are, you know, breaking out of those people pleaser ways, and this person just does not want to budge, we know then that we've given it our best shot. And at that point, for some, there comes this realization that we may need to distance for a time, not necessarily permanently, but just have a bit of breathing space. So I've seen this a lot with friendships in particular, or with certain family members. And yeah, even to an extent with romantic partners, where it feels like we're not getting anywhere with this, because here's what's happening in that situation. People pleasing, as you pointed out, involves us playing a role. You know, we take on this job within our interpersonal relationship and say, well, it's my job to kind of hang low, be quiet, dim my light, whatever it might be. So for instance, this relationship might be dependent on us being the rescuer and the other person being the victim, or us being the scapegoat and the other person, I don't know, being the person in charge, you know, sort of the overseer as such. And if we then start having boundaries, it displaces the other person's role. So they sometimes double down on that, because it's like, hold on a second, you're not doing what I expect of you. What happens with some people is that over time, because we consistently keep showing up as who we really are, and it becomes clear that this is the way it is, they go, they finally kind of give in and they start to acclimatize to that. And other people are like, yeah, I'm just going to keep butting heads with you. I'm going to criticize you, shame you, judge you, whatever it might be. At that point, I think you have to really consider distancing yourself from that person, and not in a, I'm going to punish you by distancing in the hope that you will come to heal and do as I say in control, but because it's actually the right thing for the relationship. So it's the right thing for both of you, even though the other person doesn't really have the wherewithal to actually do the right thing for it. And what you do find is sometimes you go your own way. You know, I've had this with certain friendships that were kind of based more in a people-pleasing, where you go your own way, and sometimes you reconnect over time in this different, more boundary place, because the person has self-reflected and they're willing to actually speak up and own it. If they kind of come back in and they're acting like, you know, reset button, nothing's happened, you know, trying to gaslight and whitewash over the whole thing, then you know that nothing has really changed. And some people, it's the end of the road. When it becomes clear that it is, they absolutely are dependent on you not having boundaries and always doing what they want and not meeting your own needs. How is that going to be a mutual relationship? How is that going to be a healthy relationship? And so at that point, you don't have much choice but to step away.
So important. So important. I know we're out of time and we have to talk. You got it, guys. We're all struggling with people pleasing. We all have dealt with it or continue to deal with it depending on the situation. And sometimes we're better in other situations than others. But you got to pick up the book, The Joy of Saying No, and check out Natalie and all her work. Natalie, where can people find you, connect with you, and reach out to you so they can learn more from your expertise and knowledge?
The best place to get a hold of me social media wise is on Instagram. I'm at NatLue, NatLue. And my website is natalielue.com. So NatalieLue.com. And of course, work like my podcast and the site I wrote, baggagereclaim.com, they are there as well.
Natalie, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. It means a lot to me because without you, the listeners, this podcast can't happen. So every listen, every download, every rate, review, and share means so much to me. And I hope you enjoyed these conversations as much as I did. Talking about wellness, mental health, and relationships is one of my passions, and that's what this podcast is all about. So thanks so much for tuning in. As always, if you have any questions, concerns, ideas, thoughts, collaborations, email me at thedudetherapist@gmail.com. Always feel free to DM me on Instagram at @thedudetherapist. Don't forget to be kind to yourself and to others. And as always, see you next time on the Dude Therapist podcast.